Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and all major podcast providers. So if you can't catch the show live, you can download it or simply use our free podcast player, which is available on our website at www.theorganicview.com. If you'd like to connect with us, please post a question on our wall on Facebook or send me a tweet at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@theorganicview.com. Today's show is sponsored by Austria's Finest Naturally Authentic Pumpkin Seeds and Pumpkin Seed Oil from the Steiermark, available at organicuniverse.com. Listeners of The Organic View can receive $1 off their purchase by using the coupon code ORGVIEW. That's ORGVIEW. Also, don't forget to check out our contest section on our website to submit your information for our free monthly giveaways. For more information, please visit our website at www.theorganicview.com/contests. A presidential memorandum was issued requesting that all federal agencies work together to develop a cohesive plan for pollinator protection. It was stated, quote, "The problem is serious and requires immediate attention to ensure the sustainability of our food production systems, avoid additional economic impact on the agricultural sector, and protect the health of the environment." This was the memorandum issued last June. Bee populations continue to decline, as well as other pollinator species such as the monarch butterfly. On May 19th, it was announced that under the leadership of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, otherwise referred to as EPA, and the USDA, which is the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the task force was releasing its strategy with three overarching goals. One, reduce honeybee colony losses to economically sustainable levels. Two, increase monarch butterfly numbers to protect the annual migration. And three, restore or enhance millions of acres of land for pollinators through combined public and private action. As we continue our special series called The Neonicotinoid View, my special guest co-host, Colorado beekeeper Tom Theobald, and I are going to talk to Larissa Walker, who is the Pollinator Campaign Director and a policy analyst at the Center for Food Safety, about this new strategy. So first, I'd like to welcome to the show Tom Theobald. Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon, June, from Colorado, where the work on the ARC is proceeding nicely. We're having an uncharacteristically wet spring, and it's a real stress for the bees. They can't get out and work nearly enough, but we'll make it through this, I think.
Any forecasts for the weekend, Tom?
Well, it looks like the weekend is going to continue to be rainy.
Well, thank you for that lovely
weekend. Rain.
Weekly weather forecast, which our listeners just absolutely adore. And now I'd like to welcome to the show Larissa Walker. Good afternoon, Larissa, and welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon, June. Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me back.
Hello, Larissa.
Larissa, could you take a moment to share with our listeners what you do at the Center for Food Safety and what your position is on this memorandum?
Sure. Well, Center for Food Safety is a national nonprofit organization. We have over 650,000 members nationwide, and we're dedicated to protecting public health and the environment by curbing the use of harmful food protection technologies and instead promoting sustainable alternatives. So one of the issues that we work on closely is, of course, pollinators such as honeybees, native bees, and monarch butterflies. And we've been working really hard on these issues now for several years, filing lawsuits, advocating for stronger policies to protect these species, and spearheading grassroots campaigns. So with respect to the recent White House announcement, I think we were left feeling like they could have done more. They could have done better, especially when it came to protecting these at-risk species from the harms of pesticides.
Well, I think it's interesting that last year they issued a memorandum, and in the description, it was stated that this is urgent. Now, a year later, they're issuing yet another memorandum. So it just makes me wonder, okay, well, what exactly is going to happen with this second one? And Is this just something that they're telling to put off the activists and concerned citizens until they figure out exactly what they're going to do? Because obviously industry has a very important role in this. Tom, what is your position on this?
Well, it's very frustrating, June. I don't see anything concrete coming out of this strategy proposal. There's a lot of vague concepts about how they're going to reduce the bee losses and they're going to increase the numbers of monarchs, but they give no concrete proposals for how they're going to accomplish that. And it's an embarrassing example of both incompetence and corruption, I'm afraid. And we can go into a little greater detail later if you choose, but this is a disgrace, I think. They had a year to do this. They were 5 months late, and we get this. If I were running a business and these people came to me with this sort of proposal after this investment of time and energy, I'd fire the whole lot of them.
Larissa, could you share with our listeners the research that the Center for Food Safety conducted and released last year on the decline of the monarch butterfly?
Sure. Well, Center for Food Safety was very concerned by the alarming decline in monarch butterflies, which the population in North America has declined by 90% in 20 years. So after working with our colleagues at Center for Biological Diversity and the Circe Society for Invertebrate Conservation and also renowned monarch scientist Lincoln Brower, we decided the best action moving forward to protect monarch butterflies and make sure that their populations were bound to resilient, healthy levels, petitioning for Endangered Species Act protection. So we submitted a listing petition to Fish and Wildlife Service asking that the agency, list monarch butterflies and secure stronger protections for this incredible species.
In regards to these efforts to protect the monarchs, could you share with the listeners exactly where we stand at this point, especially since we are at the beginning of a new growing season?
Sure. I mean, monarch butterfly populations here are still very, very low. Their population numbers used to be, upwards of a billion monarch butterflies that would go to Mexico for their overwintering season. And now we're down to anywhere from 30 million to 50 million monarch butterflies in that overwintering site. And that's a really, really low number, especially considering the threats that face them when they overwinter in Mexico, such as predation and severe weather events. To give an example, a single winter storm in 2002 killed roughly 500 million monarchs. And that's about 15 times the size of the current population. So it's certainly a serious issue. And the biggest threat facing monarchs right now is the lack of milkweed that's available throughout the United States. And one of the reasons that milkweed has essentially been eradicated, especially in agricultural fields throughout the Midwest and primarily the Corn Belt region, which is the heart of the monarch butterfly's breeding ground, is because of our excessive use of herbicides like glyphosate on these agricultural areas. And that's, in many ways, thanks to the creation of genetically engineered Roundup Ready corn and soybeans. So the species is such an iconic, beautiful species, and it is very much at risk right now, and it needs really strong protections immediately in order for us to ensure that it's here for future generations to enjoy.
And what has the task force proposed, Larissa, to accomplish this improvement?
Well, as June mentioned earlier in the show, the task force announced this really ambitious goal with respect to monarchs to increase their population to 225 million butterflies within the overwintering grounds by 2020. But as I just mentioned, a winter storm in 2002 killed 500 million monarchs, so twice of what they're looking to get to in, the next 5 years. I think the White House task force certainly recognizes that monarchs are important and that we need to do something to protect them, and they lay out some proposals for restoring and enhancing habitat and probably focusing on, you know, planting more milkweed habitat for them. But what they don't do is say that they're going to secure stronger protections with them, specifically by granting Endangered Species Act protection. That's the best, most comprehensive way to ensure that their populations are bound to resilient levels.
Why do you think that they did not issue federal protection so that they would ensure the survival of the monarch butterfly?
Well, currently Fish and Wildlife Service is going through a 12-month period where they're reviewing our petition. So they have some time to respond to that. They haven't responded no yet. But, you know, they didn't allude to anything of the sort in this White House announcement. I think certainly that they're hoping that by planting habitat, we can address the problem and we can improve the monarch populations. But once again, you know, the issue with the entire White House proposal is that they're really not looking at the bigger picture and the really unique and concerning threats facing not just monarchs, but honeybees, native bees, and many other species from pesticide use, whether it's herbicides wiping out milkweed plants or whether it's insecticides hurting bees and other insects. You know, it's really the plan really tried to avoid taking meaningful action with respect to regulating pesticides, and that's where it fell short.
Can we talk about habitat for just a minute? Because there are some serious questions that have been raised about habitat. The evidence is quite compelling that the environment has been poisoned at such a massive level it's almost beyond comprehension. And both the EPA and the USDA seem to be very carefully avoiding any assessment of what the contamination has been of groundwater and soils. But those tests that have been run, without exception, have shown high levels of these neonicotinoids. They're water soluble, they migrate freely, they last for decades in many cases, and they're drawn up readily by non-target plants. So in the case of the monarch, for example, while the Roundup may eliminate the milkweed, what flowering plants that remain may be, in fact, poisonous themselves. Just before this program began, I was listening to public radio, and they were talking about the establishment of a butterfly corridor diagonally across the United States, composed of several million acres. But I question whether that's going to be habitat or additional killing fields. And until we've assessed what the level of poisoning is, I don't think we can talk about habitat.
I completely agree, Tom. And I think, you know, especially in the last year, we've seen some research start to surface focusing on the impacts of neonicotinoids to monarch butterflies. And that's a new area. You know, we've seen a lot of research focusing on the impacts of neonics to honeybees and native bees, but not so much monarchs. And the evidence that's coming out shows that these chemicals are having very serious effects on monarch butterflies, as they are with bees. And I think especially given the new research that just came out earlier this month showing that bees might actually be more attracted to flowers or forage, you know, sources that are laced or contaminated with neonics. If we're planting all of this wonderful habitat and forage for them to enjoy, it's really concerning if, you know, that they're potentially drawn to these areas, the contaminated areas more. That's posing a really serious risk to them.
I was trying to think of a metaphor for this earlier, and I thought of the Middle East, where when the war comes to an end, it would be equivalent to taking a minefield and turning it into a playground without determining that all the mines are gone. I think that what has failed to be recognized and what the EPA and USDA have conveniently avoided is this is a poisoning of the earth unheard of in the history of humanity, and they have simply turned a blind eye to it. I think it's at best irresponsible. Deep-seated corruption at the management level.
Well, and it's interesting because one of the pieces that I was especially interested to come across when I was going through all of the details of the White House plan buried deep in the appendix of the plan, the EPA states, and they basically admit that neonics are a unique, they pose a unique hazard to bees. Basically, I mean, they said, quote, this pesticide class is differentiated by its unique hazard database for bees, its disposition in the environment, and frequent association with adverse effects incidents in the United States and elsewhere. So it's great that they finally come around to what independent peer-reviewed science has been saying for years, but then recognizing these unique risks with neonics didn't actually translate into specific, meaningful actions that would have addressed these threats. And that's a really big issue, I think, where we've
aren't
been
there,
having EPA
something,
for years.
Aren't there something like 200 products currently on the market, neonicotinoid products? They've done nothing to address any of those, have they?
Right, exactly. EPA came out about a month ago and announced that it would be unlikely that they'd approve more uses of neonics for outdoor applications. But exactly as you said, they're doing nothing to address all the current uses already allowed on the market, which it's estimated that could be up to 500 different neonic products on the market in the U.S. We've already got plenty of chemicals out there. It's not going to be a big deal if they don't register more.
I just wanted to make one point in regards to the impact of neonicotinoids on the monarch butterfly. I do believe Dr. Vera Krischik from University of Minnesota was the one who conducted that research. And it just goes to show you that what is happening with the bees is not only an isolated incident, but it's happening to many other species. So the exposure that these chemicals have is tremendous. Tom, could you take a moment to refresh our listeners' memories as far as the sublethal effects of neonicotinoids?
Yes, I was drawn into this about 2007 when I was trying to determine what the cause of the huge bee losses I was seeing was. I discovered a break in the fall brood cycle and through a series of investigations determined that the likely cause of that was corn pollen, and that's what got me started on this. I wrote an article in 1910 for Bee Culture magazine, and I criticized the study that had been used to give a conditional registration to clothianidin, one of the neonicotinoids. And in part as a result of that article, Bayer came back to the EPA and asked for additional approvals for both mustard and cotton. And the EPA scientists took that opportunity to review that earlier study and concluded that it was invalid. So what we have now is we have a situation where one of the primary neonicotinoids that's been on the market since 2003 has never met the requirements for legal registration, and yet it's going into its 10th year of on the market, hundreds of millions of acres, and rather than go back and correct its misjudgment, the EPA chooses instead to use its resources and our tax money to defend its actions in the court of law. This is organized crime. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. I hate to be so cynical, but this is deep corruption at the management level, and somebody needs to get in the driver's seat. I don't see that happening. The chairman of the House Agriculture Committee on Pollinators, Rodney Davis from Illinois, extolled the virtues. He's the chairman of the subcommittee. He extolled the virtues of the neonicotinoids, and his opening statement could easily have been taken from an advertising pamphlet from Bayer, and may well have. I looked into his financial records, and it just happens that agribusiness contributes about 41% of his finances. So isn't that interesting?
Larissa, I want to ask you one last question. Exactly how many lawsuits would you say the Center for Food Safety has filed in regards to the neonicotinoid issue as far as how it relates to the impact on pollinators?
We have several legal actions in the works, and not actually just for neonics, but, you know, the direction that the chemical companies are going are registering new systemic insecticides that are similar to neonics, but, you know, they're trying to get away from calling them neonics, basically saying that they're a separate subclass. So it's the next generation, if you will, of neonics. And so we're also taking legal actions to go up against those because they have the same mode of action as neonics in terms of their persistence and their propensity for contaminating the environment and impacting all of these critical species, pollinators, and beyond. And so we need to address those threats, not just neonics. There's several in the works right now.
Larissa, thank you so much. And I know that your time is limited, so I just want to say thank you for participating in this show today. And I sincerely hope that you come back to talk about some of the other issues that the Center for Food Safety campaigns about.
Absolutely, I'd love to, and thank you so much for taking the time to have me on the show tonight.
Oh, it's been fantastic.
Thank you, Larissa. I'm sure we'll talk again.
All right, bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye, Larissa. Now, Tom, I want to ask you a question. Through the years, as we've been talking about the impact of neonicotinoids as it pertains to beekeepers, exactly where are we at this point? I mean, we've been talking, and we've seen a lot of things come out by EPA, but has there actually been any changes that have been put in anything? I mean, it's just frustrating because it just seems as though you and I talk about these things every single week, and, you know, the question comes up over and over, okay, well, what's changed?
There have been changes, but unfortunately, they've been largely changes for the worse. I'm in communication with a fair number of the commercial beekeepers, and they've been struggling to maintain their numbers and keep their operations alive. And recently, there was a fair amount of publicity directed toward survey results that were issued by the Bee Informed Partnership, which showed that the annual losses for beekeepers was 42%. Now, that sounds quite dramatic, and it is, but the reality is even worse. That 42% is probably half of what the real losses are, and here's how it works. The beekeepers have to take their strong colonies and spin, sometimes into several divisions. Many of those don't make it. Many of the queens fail. Some of them die outright. Some of them have to be recombined. So if you just took a representative operation of 100, and through the course of the year, you'd had divided and redivided and recombined almost your entire population through the course of the season, and you wind up at the end of the year with 80 colonies, are your losses 20%? Well, no, your losses are closer to 100% because there's been almost a complete turnover of your population. And that's the challenge that commercial beekeepers of all sizes are faced with. They're struggling to maintain their numbers, and they're not able to keep up. This is not sustainable. We've talked about the decline of monarch butterfly, 90% in the last 20 years. Were it not for the beekeepers, that's exactly what we would see with the honeybees. Were it not for the efforts of the beekeepers keeping this population alive and pumped up, we would see an 80% decline in honeybees, and that would be indicative of similar declines among solitary bees and bumblebees and all other kinds of life forms at the lower end of the food chain. This is a massive poisoning of the environment, and for the EPA to simply turn a blind eye to it is a disgrace. It raises a fundamental question of who this task force is trying to protect. Are they protecting the pollinators, or are they protecting themselves and the chemical industry?
My last question for the show is in regards to this whole thing about millions of acres of land for pollinators. Is that even enough at this point?
Well, you know, they're proposing 7 million acres. 7 million acres is just a fraction of what's been, we know, has been contaminated. Agricultural land alone is on the order of hundreds of millions of acres. So that 7 million acres at best may represent 1 or 2% of the land that's been poisoned. And the land that's been poisoned is probably considerably more than hundreds of millions of acres, because it's also being used extensively in urban and suburban environments. Until we establish some baseline data, we can't talk about habitat improvement. It's an appealing concept, and it gets a lot of good publicity, but to do it without assessing what the baseline is irresponsible.
Well, Tom, it is, but I think for people that don't quite understand more of the details as far as the impact of neonicotinoids, could you just explain why? Can you explain why we don't have millions of acres that are healthy, that are suitable for foraging?
Well, it's because the chemicals, specifically the neonicotinoids that we've been focusing on, are water-soluble. They have half-lives of years, if not decades. They migrate readily with the groundwater. And many of the researchers believe that the effect on the nerve synapses is essentially cumulative and irreversible, which means that a very tiny fraction of what would cause an acute kill will produce the same endpoint, which is death. All you have to do is add the element of time.
And that research actually was conducted by Dr. Hank Tenekis.
Yes.
And that was the dose-time ratio, which basically cinches everything up. So at the end of the day, when it comes to the dose-time ratio, there's nothing that they can do to avoid that once or as they continue to apply these chemicals.
Well, the EPA and the USDA have conveniently turned a blind eye to an avalanche of scientific evidence. If nothing else, they're incompetent.
Well, this is a new beginning, as some people are looking at it, and hopefully we'll see some results this time. It's a shame that almost a full year has gone by and absolutely nothing has really been done. It all seems as though it's just a lot of rhetoric.
Once again, I'll say that I think that the working level employees at the EPA, perhaps to a lesser degree at the USDA, want to do the proper thing. I think what we're seeing is an example of gross mismanagement, and nobody is calling these people to account. Congress is asleep at the wheel.
Well, now that our leader is on Twitter, maybe, folks, if you're out there and it is something that you feel compelled to tweet about, maybe you should send messages to the White House, to President Obama, to the EPA, to USDA, and let them know that this is something that they need to take seriously. Tom, thanks for joining me tonight, and it was also great having Larissa on the show. But
yes, it was.
To be continued, what can I
say?
Well,
I'm going to go do a little more work on the Ark.
Noah's Ark. Folks, thank you so much for tuning in. Please check out our contest section on the website, which is www.theorganicview.com/contests. And also check out our newly revised website, where if you missed the show, you can check out the on-demand interviews, as well as all the other information, the prizes, and there's just so much information out there about neonicotinoids. But once again, thanks for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic Bee Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone.